Technology, it's such a big part of our lives. It can be fun, it can be convenient, just like this podcast, which is why University of Missouri Healthcare is proud to support podcasting on KBIA. Technology can also save your life. That's why so many people turn to University of Missouri Healthcare. Its hospitals and clinics offer you the latest technology, plus a medical team whose skill and knowledge are unparalleled. You know technology makes everyday life a lot better. Well, it's true for your healthcare, too. University of Missouri Healthcare, the care you deserve from the team you trust.
Hello, and welcome to Under the Microscope, KBIA's weekly look at stories in science, health, and technology. I'm Raymond Tungekar. Later on in the show, we'll hear an audio slideshow about trumpeter swans migrating to a bird sanctuary in eastern Missouri. But first, a virus that kills piglets is ripping through farms around the country. While it doesn't affect humans, Midwest pork producers are doing everything they can to fight it off. But as Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, the disease is proving resilient.
At Harris Vaccines, a startup company in Ames, Iowa, Anya Doolittle and Victoria Jansen wipe clean small bottles containing a white milky liquid and then apply labels. They're shipping out vaccine for porcine epidemic diarrhea, or PED. There's urgency to the work. In a total swine herd of 66 million animals, PED is likely to blame for the deaths of about a million piglets. And that toll is rising. The virus first turned up in the U.S. last spring, but Harris Vaccines founder Hank Harris had been following its impact in parts of Europe and Asia, where efforts to quell it with vaccines have not been terribly successful.
The company was interested in developing a vaccine before the virus occurred in the United States, but as soon as it occurred in the United States, that increased our interest significantly.
Harris Vaccines and other veterinary companies are pumping out vaccines, scrambling to control the outbreak. But Harris says even his current vaccine isn't enough to protect all piglets in infected herds.
It's not giving 100% protection in those situations. And so that's why we have a Generation 2 vaccine that we're developing already.
Like Harris, Sabrina Swenson of the USDA's National Veterinary Services Laboratory knew PED was out there and could come to this country.
One of our roles is to try to anticipate potential things and look to make sure that we have diagnostics in place. And many years ago, we had a concern of the potential for PED to come into the United States.
And since its arrival, PED has been spreading relentlessly. Think of a preschool classroom where the children must wash their hands several times a day. Even so, when one gets a cold, quickly most do. And they tend to get sicker than their parents and teachers. Similarly, PED spreads fast within barns and from farm to farm, even when strict biosecurity measures, the hand washing of the livestock industry, are in place. That's because it can survive in tiny bits of manure that travel on boots or trucks. Adult pigs typically recover, but Iowa State University veterinary medicine professor Rodney Baker says baby pigs do not.
The pigs die from dehydration. The baby pigs just cannot withstand losing all their body fluids as fast as they do.
Once they're older than about 10 weeks, Baker says, pigs aren't nearly as vulnerable. But new winter litters remain at risk because the virus likes the cold.
It's easy to imagine that we could have lost a million pigs, and before the winter's over, I wouldn't be surprised that the impact could be maybe 3-4 times that.
As for consumers, it's not clear yet whether bacon and ham prices will go up. Too many other factors are also in play. But Baker says the ongoing outbreak could be a bonus for some farmers.
The good news is those farmers that keep the virus out, there's economic opportunity for them compared to those that, you know, fail to keep it out.
And he says it's the smaller independent producers, ones that have fewer hogs and minimal contact with other farms, who are having the most success. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Every winter, hundreds of trumpeter swans migrate from their breeding grounds in Wisconsin to the Riverlands Migratory Bird Sanctuary just across the Mississippi River from Alton, Illinois. This year, there are about 900 of them, a record for the area. On a recent cold, blustery morning, St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon's Veronique LaCapra drove up to see and hear the swans and produce this audio postcard.
I'm Charlie Deutsch. I'm a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
My name is Lane Richter. I'm a senior ecologist at the Audubon Center at Riverlands.
It's about an hour after sunrise.
And right next to us is Pintail Pond. This is one of the areas that the trumpeter swans will roost on the water at night. There's about 200 trumpeter swans on the water right now, or on the edges of the ice, and they're just starting to wake up for the morning. The trumpeter swan has this really rich trumpet-like call.
They're a large white bird.
Their wingspan is close to 7 feet.
They're the largest waterfowl in North America. They just, you know, are an impressive sight to see when they're flying by.
The swans, before flight, they have this behavior where they'll start bobbing their heads up and down really fast. And then once they all decide that they want to fly to feed, they'll start kind of running. You can imagine it's a very large bird, 20 to 25 pounds. It takes a lot of work to get off of the water, and they're flapping their wings as hard as they can. And at that time, you actually can hear their feet smacking against the water as they're running there until they get enough speed to actually take off. The trumpeter swan faced a number of obstacles starting as early as the 1700s. Wetlands were being converted into ag fields or for other land uses. That resulted in less habitat. In addition to that, they were hunted for their feathers. In the mid-1800s, it was common for ladies to decorate their hats, and it was kind of a status symbol at the time.
So the trumpeter swans were extirpated from the Mississippi Flyway, which means they completely disappeared. They didn't go extinct because there was a small population out in the Rocky Mountains, particularly around Yellowstone, and then a population in Alaska.
By the 1930s, there are only 69 in the lower 48, 69 swans.
In the 1980s in particular, there was a pretty large effort to reintroduce the trumpeter swans to the Mississippi Flyway. And so they actually raised young trumpeter swans from some of the populations in Alaska from eggs. And they released them in marshes in Minnesota and Wisconsin and Iowa.
And slowly the population started to increase.
And those birds, over time, gradually, some of them begin to migrate, and they found Riverlands that first winter of 91-92. And we had 5 birds show up here. I actually happened to be working here then, and somebody came in and said, "Hey, there's some really big white birds out there with the yellow bands on their necks. What are they?" You know, and so we came out and, you know, figured that they were trumpeter swans. And ever since then, we've been having a growing population show up here at Riverlands.
The other day when we first counted around 900 swans in this sanctuary, right before sunset, you could see swans flying in from every direction, just kind of converging on the spot. And I think that really illustrates how important this area is for trumpeter swans.
And that'll do it for this week's Under the Microscope. I'm Raymond Tunglekar. Thanks for listening.